The following is a recording of the Sunday morning service of Rangeville Community Church.
That's what I'm talking about. People. People. What a it's such a privilege to be in the room today. There's something about when the grand narrative, the grand historical narrative of what God's doing in the universe in reconciling all things by the blood of Jesus, when that huge story that transcends time and history, transcends the globe, transcends the universe, but when that plays out in the life of someone who decided to drive into this car park to find a safe place to sleep, when that story intersects with Anthony's story, there's something that comes alive in us, right? Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It sets the tone for worship. And what an unreal experience it is to be in this room today, added in no small way by the anointed tones that were coming out of Liam's guitar as he played lead before. That was sweet, brother. Well done. The only missing ingredient, one of the most core key missing ingredients, is that you're not here. But you will be next week, and I think the excitement about that has already been shared. We are a people who gather, and so we're looking forward to doing that again. I reckon you're probably getting over hearing news about coronavirus and COVID-19 and all the havoc it is wreaking across our country, across the world, all the things that are going on. If you're anything like me, you want to delete your Facebook account, you want to shut down the internet, you just want to close everything off and go and shut your door and just sit in your room and withdraw from the world. Is it just me or are other people feeling that way? In fact, I reckon this is getting under our skin so much that you're even sick and tired of sermons that start like this with references to coronavirus. Maybe you're desperate for a different topic. A nice sermon from one of those positive, beautiful psalms. Maybe a solid exegetical piece from one of the pastoral epistles. Well, I'm sorry to tell you that today is not that day. Here we are reflecting again on the state of our world. Reflecting on where we're at. Thinking about maybe where we should be. I'll tell you something that I'm really getting sick of hearing is in Australia and then state by state or whatever, this phrase that we're all in this together. Or we'll get through this together. I mean, really? Really? If that's what people think, I don't see it happening. I see division. I see argument. I see frustration. I see different interpretations of the news. Who can we trust? Who can we not? What's true news? What's fake news? Who's right? Who's wrong? Who has the right motives and who doesn't? It's everywhere, everywhere we look. And if we're meant to get through this together, then I don't think we're going to get through it. What do we do with all this tension that we're experiencing? What do we do as people who have their allegiance to Jesus and his kingdom? How are we supposed to be different in how we respond and how we act in all of this? What do we do when so many people disagree so passionately and at times so aggressively? Because the reality is, as far as I see it, and I'm not excluding myself in this, by the way, but as far as I can see, if my Facebook feed is anything to go by, I see the church not doing much better than the rest of the world when it comes to heated debate and aggressive disagreement. And I think we should be different. Something tells me that we should be different because we belong to a system and a way of life that is not of this world. We are a part of God's kingdom community. And how do we live and treat each other and speak to one another in a world that is tied up so tightly in tension? In the Gospels we read, and sometimes we read through passages like this without really paying much attention, because they're like lists of names and they're all through Scripture, right? One of those lists in the Gospels is the list of men that Jesus in particular called, the 12 disciples that he called to be in intimate community with him, the 12 disciples. You'll know most of the names. Even if you haven't read the Bible much, I think you'll know at least four of them. But in that list, and we can read over it really quickly, and if we read over it really quickly, we miss something quite incredible that should actually blow our minds and speak to what we're considering this morning. There's two men in the list of disciples that Jesus brings together. One's name is Matthew. The other name is Simon. One is described as a tax collector, and the other is described as a zealot. So what? Well, you may already know this, but if you don't, let me explain it to you why this is remarkable. A zealot at the time when Jesus came was someone who was so frustrated and so furious at the arrogance of the Roman Empire to think that they could come into Jerusalem and occupy and desecrate the temple and be the power at the time, that they would use violence and acts of aggression and create anarchy to try and disrupt and dethrone the Roman Empire. They did this because they fully believed that they were God's anointed people and God would bring back his kingdom and his rule through violence. You might even throw the term, and I don't use this term loosely, but zealots you could call terrorists. Here is Simon, totally committed to seeing the Jewish nation, Israel, back in power like in the time of David. And he and his friends would use force and acts of aggression and violence to see that happen. Then we have Matthew, the tax collector. Well, what's a tax collector? Well, this was someone who worked for the Romans. His job, his source of income, the way that he made money was to tax his fellow Jews and give a lot of that money to the Roman government and keep some for himself as income. So he, in the eyes of many, would make his money by bleeding the Jews dry, because the more tax he collected from him, the more he could put in his own pocket. Setting that scene, can you imagine the room when Jesus first brings these 12 together? When Simon the Zealot looks across the room and sees Matthew the tax collector sitting there. This guy? Really? You cannot be serious. I reckon there was a time when, so it's not recorded in scripture, I'm just guessing. There was a time when Simon reached for that shiv that was strapped to his thigh, ready to give one to Matthew the tax collector. This wasn't a random act by Jesus. He was very intentional and prayerful about who he invited into his posse in those early moments. He intentionally chose Simon the Zealot and Matthew the tax collector and said, I'm going to bring you together and I'm going to put something before you that will trump your personal passion and your personal agenda. I'm going to put something before your eyes, before your ears, before your hearts, before your minds that is going to elevate, that is going to go far above the thing that you have thought to this point is the most important thing in the world. Jesus was establishing his kingdom on earth when he brought Matthew the tax collector and Simon the Zealot into the same intimate community. I think if you look at it and you think about disagreement, and I loved how Jordy and Emily unpacked this in the kids talk. In fact, a lot of what I'm going to go on to say is from that talk. So if you need to go back and watch that later on, I think that they did a really good, deep job of what I'm going to try and do later. But we'll get there. But I think what you try to do when you disagree, whether it's the colour or the breakfast cereal, whatever it is about disagreement, the way that we approach it is we need to convince the other person that we are right and point out why they are wrong. That's the way that debate happens. You unpack the person's argument, you show the weakness of it all, and then you present your case as fact and true, and why everyone who's listening, which often isn't many people, even the person you're trying to convince, of why you are right. And again, I think this would have been simmering with Matthew and Simon in that room. And they're looking to Jesus to say, well, which one of us is right? Which one are you going to get alongside? Which agenda is right here? And Simon probably had hopes that Jesus was going to lead a military attack on the Roman government. And Matthew was probably sitting there thinking, how can we make money out of this guy? I don't know. But they, each one would have been hoping that Jesus would come alongside their agenda. But Jesus, and we have no record at all, other than Simon was a zealot and Matthew was a tax collector. We have no record of conversations they had with each other. We have no record of Jesus taking them aside and having conversations about their tax collecting and their zealousness. What we do know, though, is that instead of addressing their personal agendas, Jesus presented something that was far more compelling and completely trumped their personal passions and their agendas. Their passionately held positions became superseded by his glory. So much of the tension we're experiencing right now, the social tension that exists, is so often, and this is where I see it played out so much in our country and around the world, is in the area of politics. Again, my Facebook feed, the news is consumed with political tension and political disagreement, and we are not exempt from it in this country. What I find so incredible is the community that Jesus started, that included Matthew the tax collector and Simon the zealot, that started to grow after Jesus' death and resurrection and ongoing reign, this community that formed in those very early years, when you look at it and you look at what made it distinct and what some of those characteristics were, and you hold it against the backdrop of 2020 and the political tension that exists in the world, but also in the church, you see something very surprising. Church historians, people a lot smarter than me who have researched this, they see five really key characteristics and distinctives of the church community that was growing in the world back then. These were it. The first distinctive is that they were pro-life. There were laws and there was a way of life that was so rejecting of particularly young girls, but also any deformities in kids. These kids were, and I'm sorry to put it this way, but they were literally thrown into the streets. This was all legit. This was fine in the eyes of Rome. In fact, it made sense to them. But what the church started to do was adopt those babies. They started to care for those babies, and they were pro-life. Their abortion was rank at the time, but they would encourage women, and they would get around women and support them, and they would adopt these young babies. They were pro-life. The other distinctive of the early church was that they had a very countercultural sexual ethic. And that was, it only existed in a committed relationship, a covenant relationship between a man and a woman. And this was at a time, and there isn't a lot of difference, even though the media has changed a lot, sexual promiscuity was rank at the time. And here's this community that only practiced sex in the context of marriage between a man and a woman, to the exclusion of all others. That was so countercultural. The third distinctive is that they were non-retaliatory. This is important when we talk about politics. If they were criticized, if they were put down, if they were abused, they would not retaliate. And that was quite remarkable and distinctive at the time. The fourth distinctive is that they were multiracial. At a time when races kept to themselves and didn't cross over and didn't cross-pollinate and all those sorts of things, this was a community that was very multiracial. And the fifth distinctive is that they cared for the poor in a way that impressed the Roman government, even though they didn't like it because it meant that Christianity was gaining ground. They cared for the poor like the poor had never been cared for before. There's five distinctives: pro-life, countercultural sexual ethic, non-retaliatory, a multiracial community, and they cared for the poor. Now, if you think about it against the backdrop of today, the first two, do they not sit really neatly on the right side of politics? And the final two, the fourth and the fifth, do they not sit comfortably on the left side of politics? And in the middle, we have this one that fits on neither side of politics, because retaliation happens all over the place. The point here is that this community that came together, you could not nudge into a political allegiance. It was a new political regime. It was a new politic that was going on when Jesus was establishing his kingdom on earth. And this is a community that is described as being where there's no distinction between Jew or Greek, slaves or free, male or female. This is a new community. No left side or right side of politics. And this was happening in the midst of the tension that existed, like in boil over rates in the Roman world at the time. So much we can draw from this as we consider this today. How do we recapture, and how do we get back? Because I really think we need to get back to it. How do we become this community again? And this is where I lean so much on what Jordan and Emily said earlier. And I'm just going to remind us really briefly of the three things that I think we can do. The first one is listening before speaking. I wrote this, I'm going to change the word. I actually wrote become aggressively, but it doesn't work. So I'm going to say become passionately inquisitive about the other person's story. I don't know about you, but I was quite moved in that children's talk when Emily explained why she loves something that I actually found quite disgusting. Like hot water on Weet-Bix, just put hot milk in there, come on. When she said, it's a memory, and every time I eat it, I think of my childhood. If you want to argue that she's wrong by saying that this is a great way to eat Weet-Bix, you risk not hearing that beautiful story. So instead of thinking, and you know what I've realized as humans, and I'm so guilty of this, we love to speak. And we don't listen because we're waiting for our turn to speak. But so key in this, in being kingdom people, is to be passionately inquisitive about the other person's story. To ask questions and to understand, even if they have views that repel you and are on the other side of the planet from you, ask them why. Ask to hear their story. Listen before speaking. A second thing, become passionately committed as well to knowing your own sense of not knowing everything. You do not know everything. You can't possibly know everything. If this is what you know, the whole room is full of the knowledge of the world. You cannot possibly know everything. But we like to speak on any and every topic where people will listen. And this is, as Emily and Geordie described, humility. Humility. Getting a sense of our own insignificance and our own sense of not knowing everything, and therefore having a posture towards our brothers and sisters in Christ, but then our posture to the world that is humble. And we see a beautiful example of that in Jesus. And the third thing is to, as Geordie and Emily said, look to God. I had worship Jesus as King. Worship Jesus as King. Here's the reality about Jesus. We have 42,000 denominations in the world or thereabouts. Different views on Jesus, different views on what he was passionate about and what he stood against and what he stood for and all that sort of thing and what his priorities were. Man, we are so good at creating our own perspectives on that stuff. But here's the reality. Jesus is completely secure in who he is despite what you might think he is. He is completely secure in who he is in spite of the many and varied opinions of what we think he is. And the other thing is, he's incredibly patient in inviting us into relationship with him to get to know him better. We need to worship Jesus as King. We need to take a knee before Jesus. And in our quest to humbly listen, to listen before speaking, and to have a posture of humility, we need to take that same posture before Jesus to say, you know what? You do know everything. You are the King of Kings. You are the Lord of Lords. And before I speak for you, I want to know you, and I want to hold you in the place that you belong in, which is as King in my life, and taking that humble posture before him. There's this amazing event in the Old Testament. I don't like to call it a story because I believe it was history. This amazing historical event recorded in the Old Testament. And in this event, God told Moses at a time of crisis and great tension among the Hebrews, among the mobile people of God, when snakes had come into the camp and were biting people to the point of them losing their lives, God told Moses to do something pretty remarkable. He said, I want you to take some bronze and fashion it into a snake, wrap that snake around a pole and hold it up in the middle of the camp. And then I want you to say, everyone who looks at this bronze snake will be healed from the poison that is throbbing through their veins. Can you imagine being there at this moment? You probably would have been bitten by a snake. And I know that some maybe have had that experience. I haven't, but I imagine it'd be quite painful and terrifying. Do you think in this moment, when God's people were so weak and suffering, do you think in this moment that the existing tensions, and there were existing tensions, people were complaining, people were so sick of traveling, they were complaining against Moses, they would have been fighting with each other, all these tension existed. Do you think in this moment of weakness for them that any of that mattered? Do you think that was even on their mind? I'm dying here from poison, but by the way, you're wrong and I'm right. That would not have been on their radar at all. All they knew was that if I look at this bronze snake, the promise is I will be healed from wherever I am in the camp. And whatever is in my hand, whatever I carry with all that I am, all I need to do is to acknowledge my weakness and look at this snake and I will be healed. Absolutely amazing. And it happened. As they looked, some didn't. I don't know why. But most did. When they looked, they were healed from this poisonous snakebite. Here's what stands out to me about this moment, apart from the fact that right in that moment, none of their personal passions and perspectives on things would have mattered other than getting healed. But here's what stands out to me. What God didn't say to Moses is, I want you to get the people to line up in a queue. And as they come through the gate, they look, then they will be healed. No. They looked to the bronze snake in a circle. They didn't come through the same door. They didn't come through a queue. So wherever they were and whatever was in their mind, whatever they had experienced over the last years of their life, they didn't have to line up through the same door to come through in order to be healed. They did it in a circle. They did it in a circle. No two people looked in the same direction. No two people looked in the same direction. Everyone was looking in a different direction, but at the same thing. That's remarkable. And here's why I find it so remarkable and so important for us with what we're thinking about this morning. Jesus referred to this event, this history, when speaking of his death. He said that if I be lifted up, like Moses lifted up that bronze snake, then I will draw all men and women to myself. That is the only way that people will be healed. That is the only way, acknowledging a weakness and looking to him. This is actually the only way that we can all be in this together. And when we look at Jesus, what he doesn't say is, I want you to come through this prepared door and I want you to get yourself ready and right and then appear at the door and then I'll look at you, you look at me, and then you get healed. No. From where you are, whatever situation you're in, camping in a church car park, you look to Jesus and in that moment you're healed. People don't have to walk through the same door to come to him. They look at him from a circle, not by joining a queue. At a time like this, the world is desperate, without even knowing it, to look at a community that can genuinely be in this together. And the only way to be in this together is to acknowledge that we all need Jesus, that he is the one, he is the focal point. And we don't come to him in a queue, we come to him in a circle. And as we invite people to look at him, they look at him from whatever their story is, from whatever their background is, and it's in that moment of simply lifting their eyes to look at him, that they are healed. Not getting themselves together to join the queue, but to look at him from wherever they are in their life. As we come to communion, I think I need to move this over a bit. We think about the bread and the cup. And what I love about this is that Jesus set this up around a table. Sometimes I think of when I was in high school and we would have communion. I'd never go forward because I went to a school that wouldn't have allowed me to partake of communion. But people would have to queue up and you'd have to wait your turn to be blessed and then you would eat and drink. What I love about the first communion is that Jesus didn't do it like that. He did it around a table. He did it around a table, a circle, where the focus, and no two of the disciples were looking in the same direction. They were just looking at the same thing. They were looking at Jesus as he said, this is my body and this is my blood. I'm sure that none of his disciples, even for 1 minute, considered that when he would be lifted up, that it would be on a cross. I'm sure they thought that it would be on a throne. But no, it was on a cross. Because in humility, listening to his Father, he submitted and was obedient and went down that path for us. And so we eat and drink together to remember that and to remember our weakness, his grace, his strength. And in doing that, we remember that our oneness is not the result of our political affiliation. Our oneness is not our preferences in worship, our denominational heritage. It's not even in the fact that we're all part of Rangeville Community Church. It's the blood and body of Jesus that we look to him together as one.
That concludes our sermon recording. Thank you for listening. If you have any questions or require further information, please contact our church office on 07 46 36 11 44, or you can email us office@rangeville.com.